This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on third semester New Testament Greek. This is session number 11 on the imperatives.
The last mood that we want to discuss is the imperative mood, and I've devoted a individual lecture to it just because there's a couple of additional issues involved in interpreting the imperative mood. And we said the imperative mood could be understood as the mood of direction. That is, the author is not making an assertion about an action or projecting an action, but is attempting to direct an action towards the readers, or direct the readers towards an action. One could see it as kind of the furthest removed from the conception of or attitude towards the relationship of the action to reality, in that it's solely dependent on the response of the reader to the author's to the imperative mood. One thing that is different in the imperative from English is, in English, and again, it's not that we can't express this, we just can't do it in the same way Greek does, but Greek, like English, has a second person imperative, and now we need to remember our lesson on person in a previous lecture, but Greek and English both have second person imperatives where the author is commanding or directing the action of the reader that he's addressing, hence second person. Greek also has a third person imperative, which we don't have in English. And we're often, we are often told in some grammars to translate the third person imperative, let him or let her. And sometimes that's appropriate. For example, in Ephesians 4, Paul says, do not let the sun go down on your anger. And that's a third person imperative. And clearly, Paul, you know, I think do not let the sun go down. That's probably an appropriate translation, because obviously the sun can't do anything. Paul's not literally commanding the sun, and his readers just sit around and hope that the sun obeys. They're the ones that are supposed to enact this in a sense. So, but at other times, to translate it let, it sounds more like I am telling you to give something permission. And that's not quite the force. This is still an imperative. We're just not used to it in English because we don't do this. But even in the Greek language, a third-person imperative, the author is still commanding and directing an action. But in this case, it's not second person, but it's a third person. But even then, it still may be, like the Ephesians 4 passage, it still may be relevant to or a call for the readers to participate in this and to carry this out, even though Paul is commanding a third person. So just be aware of that, that Greek has a third person imperative that we do not have in English. And let the sun go down, or you know, let that person, or let that man, or let that person do this. I think sometimes it would be appropriate to say he should or she should do this. Just so we don't get the idea that the force of a third person imperative is to give permission to somebody. That's not quite the force of it. It's still a command. It's still an imperative. It's just directed as a third person rather than a second person. And we just need to be sensitive in the context to how we translate it and how we bring out the force of the imperative. What I want to focus on with imperatives is there are basically four general types of constructions when it comes to how the imperative mood functions. And one way to do it is we can I'll write up a chart, and I'll divide it into four parts. And the way to look at this is Greek can, and let me erase this for a moment. We're talking about imperative, the imperative mood. But Greek can express, with the imperative mood, Greek can express a command or a prohibition. And the prohibition is just the flip side of a command. A command is more positive, do this, where the prohibition is the don't do this. And Greek also can express a command or prohibition in either the aorist tense or with the present tense. So you have four possibilities: an aorist command, or an aorist prohibition, or a present command, or a present prohibition. The way that an aorist command is expressed is with an aorist imperative, an aorist verb in the imperative mood. The way that a present command is expressed is with an imperative in the present tense form. Now, for prohibitions, the way that an aorist prohibition is expressed is with the aorist subjunctive with may, except in third person. In third person, which is less common, the Greek does use the imperative form. But the most common prohibition is second person, and Greek uses the aorist subjunctive, not the aorist imperative, but the aorist subjunctive, second person, with may. Whereas present prohibitions are expressed with the present imperative, with may. So those are formally, how these four commands and prohibitions in aorist and present are expressed. Now the question becomes, well, what's the difference between them? What are their meanings? Again, very commonly, the aorist imperative was often understood as indicating ingressive action. That is, an aorist imperative was used when the action was not taking place and the readers were commanded to begin it. And so you'd even see some grammar saying, in translate it, start doing this, or start or begin to do this. Sometimes you often saw this. Another kind of rule that grew up around this is aorist imperatives were used of specific commands. That is, commands that were kind of one-off. And when Jesus commands his disciples, go untie the donkey, that's not something that they're supposed to do every day or the rest of their lives, or that we're supposed to do. It was a one-time event. And so it was often thought aorist commands are used for specific, occasional commands as opposed to the present. We'll look at that in a moment. And then the aorist subjunctive, used for aorist prohibitions, was often seen as a command not to start. So don't start. The assumption then is the readers aren't doing this and they're being commanded not to. So like if your child is about ready to run out into the street and they haven't done it, you'd say, don't run out in the street. It's a command not to begin to do that, not to even initiate it, not to start the action. It's prohibiting them from doing something that they're not yet doing. And it was thought that that was the use of the aorist prohibition. When it came to the present tense, present imperatives are often seen as a command to keep on doing something that you're already doing. Or often seen as general or habitual type of commands that should characterize your life, as opposed to the aorist, which was specific, one-off, untie the donkey, and now this is love your neighbor, something like that, a general command. The present imperative was often thought to mean stop doing something that you're already doing. See, the assumption was the readers are already doing it and they're being told to stop doing it. So this is a, especially in older type of grammars, this is a fairly standard understanding of these four types of constructions: the aorist imperative, aorist command, start an action, or a specific command to do it, just a one-off thing, or a prohibition, don't even start it, don't begin to do this, as opposed to the present imperative, keep on doing something you're already doing, or do something habitually, general imperatives that are relevant for all times and all readers, or the present prohibition to stop doing an activity that you're already engaged in. All right? The only problem with that scheme is it doesn't work. And the more you look at examples in the Greek New Testament, the more exceptions that you find to all of these. For example, there are plenty of places where you find an aorist imperative of commands that the context is not clear at all whether the readers are engaged in it or not. Or specific commands. There are examples of the aorist imperatives for commands that are not specific. If anyone has ever paid attention to how the book of 1 John ends, 1 John ends, if I can find it, 1 John ends with an imperative. There it is, 1 John. Children, guard yourselves from idols. Thulaxata. I'll write it out just so you can see it. Thulaxata. That's an aorist imperative. Is John commanding them just one time, guard yourself from idols in this instance? That seems to be a general, fairly general command that should characterize the lifestyle of the reader, something that they should do over and over again, and that we should do as well. So there are other examples. If you want to see more examples in the grammar, intermediate Greek grammar that Professor Emig and I wrote, we have other examples of general commands in the aorist tense that are clearly in the context of lifestyle commands of that we should follow a certain lifestyle, not just one time. Yes, there are lots of examples. The aorist tense, the summary command, is suitable for specific commands, and you do find a lot of examples of that. But that's more of, an observation or pattern than it really is a rule. And then, prohibitions don't start. Again, the difficulty is, there are examples of the aorist prohibition, second person subjunctive, used in context where the action is already taking place. There was an article written back in the 1950s that's not very accessible, written by a Greek scholar named Johannes Lau, or Johannes Low, and he wrote an article that on imperatives, and he demonstrated from Greek text outside of the New Testament that this didn't work. He demonstrated examples of aorist prohibitions used in contexts where the action was already taking place. One example I would point to that I ran across is in John chapter 3 with Jesus' interaction with Nicodemus. Remember when Pharisee Nicodemus comes to Jesus at night, and you find their interaction recorded in chapter 3. And in verse 7, this is John chapter 3 and verse 7, Jesus tells Nicodemus, "Do not marvel thaumaseis." Do not marvel. An aorist subjunctive prohibition. If you read the context, he's already shocked and marveled. He can't believe what Jesus is telling. You mean I have to be born again? How can someone be born again? What's this rebirth and the spirit that you're talking about? Nicodemus is already shocked and marveling and surprised at what Jesus is saying. So that doesn't work. to say don't start to marvel because Nicodemus is already marveling. So I just gave you one example from John 3:7, but there are others in the New Testament and outside of the New Testament where the rule simply doesn't fit. The present imperative, keep on doing something you're already doing, or general imperatives. Again, I would say this last one is, again, like the specific commands with the aorist imperative, is probably a general observation and a pattern that often works. The present tense looking at an action as developing or unfolding is suitable for describing actions that should be characteristic and general. But again, there are too many exceptions where that does not fit and does not work, especially the keep on. When you look at Romans chapter 6, for example, you find, actually that would fit with prohibitions, but you do find a number of examples of imperatives in Paul's letters where the present tense is used, for example, in the letter to the Ephesians. Starting in chapter 4, there are a number of imperatives or commands that occur in the present tense. And so you can look at virtually any section, but verse 15, be careful or watch carefully how you walk. Blepete, that is a present imperative. Yet there's nothing in the context. Again, let me write that out. That is Ephesians 5:15, and the imperative is blepete, a present imperative. Yet you read the context, there's no indication at all whether the readers are watching carefully or not. And so to translate this keep on watching doesn't seem to be appropriate because the context doesn't tell us, is Paul telling them to continue doing something they already are, or is he telling them to stop something, or is he telling them to start something that they're not yet doing? The context is not clear. And there's all kinds of examples of that in Paul's letters where it's really not clear whether they are doing this or not. And there are examples in the Gospels where Jesus commands his disciples to do something one time, but he uses the present tense. Where the context, it doesn't work to say this is a general command or it's habitual, something they should be doing all the time. No, the context makes it clear. Jesus is making a command in the present tense, but it's a command to only do something once. Then what about this one? Stop. There was an article written by a guy named James Boyer years ago, a brilliant teacher and Greek scholar at Grace Theological Seminary, and he actually wrote an article on imperatives, and he argued that less than half of present imperatives with may stop doing it fit. And that's only because the context has to make it clear that the readers are doing it before you can conclude that it's a command to stop. In fact, most of the context, it's not clear. Romans 6, I was just starting on a minute ago. Romans chapter 6 and verse 12. Paul says, therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body. Again, when you look at the context, there is no indication anywhere that, you know, Paul's telling the readers, oh, you're already sinning, so you need to stop it. There's no indication at all. And so it would be illegitimate to translate this stop. But the best one that I think of was, my attention was drawn to it by James Boyer, the person that I just mentioned. And it's found in Luke's gospel. In at the very end of the gospel, although all the gospels have the account of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, if I can find it, in the Jesus prayer in the in the Mount of Olives in the garden as he approached his impending death. In chapter 22 of Luke, so we're talking about Luke 22 and verse 42. This is a section where Jesus is praying, Father, if there's any way for this cup to pass from me, if there's any other way for this to be, for you to accomplish your purpose, you have my vote. But then Jesus goes on and says, however, not my will, but your will be done. And there is a may. A may and a third person imperative. That is a present prohibition construction. Should we translate that as Jesus saying, stop letting my will be done? So Jesus was getting his way and his will being done, and then now at this point he wants that to stop? You read the Gospels, and that's not the case. Jesus, especially John's Gospel, where over and over again, he's only come to do the will of the Father. He's only come to speak what the Father tells him to. So this is a clear case where this rule doesn't work. In fact, theologically, it contradicts the rest of the Gospels. If we were to translate this, stop letting my will be done, in other words, it's just a prohibition in the present tense. Don't let my will be done. And again, a lot of other present prohibitions, there's just nothing in the context to indicate whether the action is taking place or not. So I think the appropriate response is to kind of lay aside these rules and then when we start asking, well, how should we handle pres aorist imperatives and aorist prohibitions, present imperatives and present prohibitions? An aorist prohibition is simply commands an action as a complete whole. Whether that action is one time and specific, whether it has begun or not, whether it is characteristic and general and should always be true, that can only come from the context. The aorist imperative is just a summary command to do something. Whether they're doing it or not, whether it's once or over and over again, is only determined by the context. Likewise, the aorist prohibition prohibits an action as a complete whole. It's just do not do it. And again, whether the action is already taking place or not cannot be determined, can only be determined by the context. And then the present imperative. The present imperative commands an action as in progress or seen as developing or unfolding. And once again, the present imperative itself does not tell you whether the action is already taking place and they're told to keep doing something they're already doing, or whether they're not doing it and they need to start, or the context doesn't tell you. It often is used of general commands, but sometimes you see it used of specific commands, for example, in narrative literature and the Gospels. But all the present imperative does, consistent with aspect. Remember we said everything we talked about aspect is true with imperatives. The present imperative simply commands an action viewed as in progress, developing and unfolding. And then likewise, the present imperative prohibits an action as in progress. Viewed as in progress or developing. And again, there's by saying it's in progress, it doesn't mean it's already going on and they're being told to stop. It says the action is viewed as developing or unfolding, as opposed to simply seeing it as a complete whole. So again, it's simply saying, don't do this. Or, you know, if you want to be real wooden, you could say, don't be doing this. But whether they're already doing it or not, only the context can tell you. Sometimes, like the example in Luke 22 with Jesus, the context is clear that it's not, the action is not going on, and stop doesn't work. Sometimes, I'd say more often, the context doesn't tell you, and you still have to refrain from, you know, we have to translate it, stop. It's just a prohibition not to do an action that is viewed as in progress, as developing or unfolding. And only the context can tell you whether that's going on or not, or it's indecisive. So, again, when it comes to imperatives, I think we need to be careful of some of these rules. It's not that you can't find them followed. There are examples, but that comes from the context. And there's enough exceptions to those so-called rules that indicates that they're really not rules at all. And instead, we should pay closer attention to the context and focus on the aspect of the imperatives and what they say about how the author views the action that he's commanding or prohibiting.
This is Dr. David Mathewson in his teaching on third semester New Testament Greek. This is session number 11 on the imperatives.